Welcome to the Aaron Wren Newsletter Audio Edition. For more content and to subscribe, visit aaronwren.com. That's AAROONREN.com. Newsletter number 74, Great Literature is Right Wing, originally published on March 13, 2023. People involved in the arts, literature, or other creative fields are generally politically left-wing, even far left. It's much rarer to see someone who is explicitly and openly to the right, though it does happen occasionally. But there's another way to look at it. Our ideas of left and right in politics descend from the French Revolution. But what if we define them differently than we currently do? My preferred definition of the right, properly understood, is discerning and aligning oneself and the world around him with the truth. Now, as a political philosophy or program, this is obviously incomplete, but a commitment to truth is important. Erich von Kuhnelt-Leden made this point when he said, quote, "The true rightist is not a man who wants to go back to this or that institution for the sake of return. He wants to find out what is eternally true, eternally valid, and then either to restore or reinstall it, regardless of whether it seems obsolete, whether it is ancient, contemporary, or even without precedent, brand new, ultra-modern. Old truths can be rediscovered, entirely new ones found. The man of the right does not have a time-bound, but a sovereign mind," unquote. I would probably qualify this somewhat. Some truth is contingent, not eternal. And one truth is also that man is limited and fallen, and thus can never perfectly discern the truth. This should apply a strong dose of humility to our quest for truth, though truth itself should remain our North Star. Thus, because great art often expresses truth, that art is implicitly right-wing regardless of the politics of the creator. The best art, journalism, etc., often overflows the intentions of its creator. When conservative American Christians talk about literature, they are likely to pick explicitly Christian figures like C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, or Flannery O'Connor. These are fine figures, but ones of a previous era. The main novelist of today who might make that list is Marilynne Robinson. Those who have the greatest insights for today's world, however, are often not Christian at all. Sometimes this makes their work offensive to American Christian readers. But for those who pay careful attention, they will often find incredible truth, particularly about the nature of contemporary society and its deformations, hiding in plain sight. Today, I want to give some examples of this in the form of three contemporary European literary figures, Hanna Ørstavik, Karl-Uwe Knausgård, and Michel Houellebecq. Hanna Ørstavik. Hanna Ørstavik, HANNEORSTAVIK, is a 53-year-old Norwegian writer. She is, like many of the most incisive writers about our world today, Generation X, at least so far as such a label could be applied in Norway. She's a writer I only recently discovered, and only four of her books have been translated into English, but they are all good. Her 2006 book Love, widely considered her masterpiece, is highly unusual in that it is a story about a single mother behaving badly towards her child. The hippieist Vibeka has just moved to a new small town in Norway to start a new position, bringing along her son John, who will turn 9 years old the next day as the book opens. Why she moved is never revealed, though another relationship failure is a possibility. John's father is out of the picture, and his mother has programmed him to say of this, "My mom had to get away. She was too young to be tied down." In other words, his mother dumped his father without good cause. John leaves the house to sell raffle tickets, leaving space he's sure his mother wants in order to bake him a birthday cake. His adventures have an ominous tone about them, as if something terrible is about to happen to him, but everyone treats him well. His mother soon leaves the house too, but as we discover, she's completely forgotten John's birthday. She's looking for adventure, and maybe a hookup, for herself. She's essentially oblivious to her son, who is clearly just baggage she's stuck with. Rather than a vicious psycho killer in the village, we discover that it is her neglect that is the greatest danger to little John. The Guardian described Love as a chilling study of emotional distance. The New York Times called it a trim and electrifying novel, at fewer than 200 pages and without graphic sex or other features that might mar it for the Christian readers. Of all the books I discuss in this newsletter, this is one you might want to sample if you're tempted. A mother behaving badly is also a theme in Ørstavik's novel The Blue Room. In that book, college student Johanna wakes up to discover she's been locked in her room, As the book progresses, we discover that it was her mother who did it in order to prevent her from going to America for 6 weeks with a boy she met at school. This might seem admirable at one level, but we also learn that her mother is manipulative, controlling, and deeply hypocritical. She is, of course, also a single mother, with Johanna's father nowhere to be found. As The Guardian put it, quote, "We have here a very strong entrant in that subcategory of fiction novels called novels with creepy mothers in them. Johanna's mother is definitely one of the worst." Unquote. Another online reviewer said, quote, "A recent Twitter meme was asking for examples of bad parents in literature, and Johanna's mom would be right up there." Unquote. I should note that The Blue Room has strong sexual content. It's interesting to see not just one, but two books here featuring single mothers behaving badly. Love especially holds up a mirror to the dark side of single motherhood, something American Christians can't allow themselves to confront, preferring instead to view them through rose-colored glasses as heroes. Interestingly, in The Blue Room, Johanna and her mother are both, supposedly, devout Christians. Another Ustavik book is about a female pastor in Finland. It makes me wonder what her own relationship to Christianity is. Karl-Ove Knausgård. If Ustavik's Love is basically a novella, fellow Norwegian author Karl-Ove Knausgård went to the other extreme with his six-volume, 3,600-page work of autofiction, that is, autobiographical fiction, My Struggle. This book was both a sensation and a scandal in Norway, selling almost 500,000 copies there. Keep in mind, the total population of Norway, including children, is only 5.3 million. This success turned Knausgård into a global literary superstar. Age 54, he too is Generation X. It's difficult to describe Knausgård's writing. His books are often seemingly about nothing but the banalities of everyday life, yet they are oddly compelling. They're like a train wreck you can't stop watching. The best introduction to his style and work can be found in a two-part New York Times Magazine story called My Saga, in which he's asked to retrace the paths of the Vikings in America. But make no mistake, he's very smart, very widely and deeply read, and an extremely good observer. While again, he would claim to be left-wing, there's a strong right-wing streak about his work. He even seems to acknowledge this with a twinkle in his eye at some point. Start with the fact that his magnum opus shares a title with Hitler's infamous work, which is more explicit in its Norwegian title, Mein Kampf. Apparently he's never even read Hitler before commencing his own series, but in the last volume he includes a very powerful 400-page interlude on Hitler, which starts with a 75-page analysis of Paul Celan's poem Stretto, a meditation on death in the wake of the Holocaust. It's also notable that the New York Times chose Knausgård to write a review of Michel Houellebecq's Submission, which we'll talk about momentarily, also widely seen as having right-wing themes. My Struggle is right-wing in multiple senses. First is descriptions. His boomer parents are divorced, presumably in the first generation where this was widespread. His father drinks himself to death and dies in utter squalor. We see where the boomer me-generation ethos leads. In its minute depictions of the banalities and struggles of contemporary life, we see the absurdity of so much of the modern day. He also makes many explicit observations and statements that might well get one canceled today, something he avoids partly through the conceit that he's writing a character in a novel. For example, while he's intellectually egalitarian, he can't help but see his participation in childcare as demasculinizing. Quote, "One's self-image not only encompasses the person you are, but also the person you wanted to be, could be, or once had been. For the self-image, there was no difference between the actual and the hypothetical. It incorporated all ages, feelings, and drives. When I pushed my stroller all over town and spent days taking care of my child, it was not the case that I was adding something to my life, that it became richer as a result. On the contrary, something was removed from it, part of myself, the bit relating to my masculinity. It was not my intellect that made this clear to me, because my intellect knew I was doing this for a good reason, namely that Linda and I would be on equal footing with regards to our child, but rather my emotions, which filled me with desperations whenever I squeezed myself into a mold that was so small and so constricted that I could no longer move. The question was which parameter should be operative. If equality and fairness were taken to be the parameters, well, there was nothing to be said about men sinking everywhere to the thralls of softness and intimacy, nor about the rounds of applause this was met with, for if equality and fairness were the dominant parameters, change was an undoubted improvement and a measure of progress. But these were not the only parameters. happiness was one, and an intense sense of being alive was another. And it may be that women who followed their careers until they were almost in their 40s and then at the last moment had a child, which after a few months the father took care of until a place was found in the nursery so that they could both continue their careers, may have been happier than women in previous generations. It was possible that men who stayed at home and looked after their infants for 6 months might have increased their sense of being alive as a result. And women may actually have desired these men with thin arms, large waistlines, shaven heads, and black designer glasses, who were just as happy discussing the pros and cons of baby Bjorn carriers and baby slings as whether it was better to cook one's own baby food or buy ready-made ecological purees. They may have desired them with all their hearts and souls, but even if they didn't, it didn't really matter because equality and fairness were the parameters. They trumped everything else in life and a relationship consisted of. It was a choice, and the choice had been made for me as well. Unquote. He says in another volume, quote, "It's a known fact that children of divorce are overrepresented in the crime figures, and the younger they were when parents divorced, the greater risk of them getting into trouble. But we won't give up the right to divorce, so instead we say it's best for the kids. In any system, it's impossible to foresee all the effects. To get back to the automobile, if anyone had said the invention of the automobile was going to kill thousands of people every year, would we have put it into production and center our lives around it the way we have? No, so we don't talk about that. We say that the automobile brings us freedom and opportunity. And when capitalism increased its hold and we needed more labor, did anyone say that women have got to leave the home now and start producing goods so that we can double the labor force? Not to mention double the number of consumers? No, they didn't. That was women wanting the same rights as men. The right to work. What kind of a right is that? How's that supposed to be liberating? It's just the opposite. A prison. The consequence of that is that our kids are farmed out to an institution from the age of 2, and what happens then? Mom and dad are almost always driven insane, aren't they? They're riddled with guilt, so they spend all of the time they can on their kids when they're not at work, trying to be as close to them as possible. Compensation, compensation, compensation." Unquote. He also speaks disparagingly of Sweden, and repeatedly highlights its many cultural differences from Norway. Quote, "Oh, how I hated this, beep, little country, and how smug they were. If everything was how it was in Sweden, that was normality. Anything that was different was abnormal. And this at the same time as embracing all the multicultural and minority issues. The poor immigrants who came from Ghana or Ethiopia to the Swedish basement laundry room, having to book a slot 2 weeks in advance, and then getting your ears chewed out if you left a sock in the tumble dryer, or being subjected to a man appearing at the door with one of those damned IKEA bags in his hand and sarcastically asking if, by any chance, it's yours. Sweden hasn't had a war on its soil since the 17th century, and how often did it cross my mind that someone ought to invade Sweden, bomb its buildings, starve the country, shoot down its men, rape its women, and then have some faraway country, Chile or Bolivia, for example, embrace its refugees with kindness, tell them they love Scandinavia, and dump them in a ghetto on the outside of the cities, just to see what they would say. Perhaps the worst aspect of all of this was that Sweden was so admired in Norway. I had been the same when I lived there. I knew nothing, of course. But now that I knew and tried to tell people at home in Norway, no one understood what I meant. It is impossible to describe exactly how conformist this country is. Also, because the conformity is laid bare by an absence, opinions diverging from the norm do not, in fact, exist in public. It takes time for you to notice." Unquote. The ghetto outside the city is, of course, where Sweden has dumped its migrants. He makes a number of observations on this, which we'll see momentarily. If two countries so ethnically and linguistically similar have such a cultural gulf, what does that say about multiculturalism? He says, quote, "The wonder of Japan, a country that had been isolated for so many hundreds of years and had developed what seemed to us in every way to be such a peculiar culture, of that culture dissolving into that of the West and being lost forever, to exist as a mere variation of our own, was as great a loss as the extinction of any species of animal. But the Western world was so strong and so expansive in its nature that it would soon have the rest of the world subsumed within it, not by violence as in the days of colonialism, but by promise. In this wide perspective, I was against immigration, against multiculturalism, against notions of sameness of every kind." Unquote. He also writes this further passage, which might have come from an American culture warrior today. Quote, "When I was a kid, the last day of school was a solemn occasion, We sang the national anthem, but that was banned. They said it was racist to sing the national anthem. Can you imagine? I could indeed. Equality was the supreme principle. And one of the consequences was that expressions of the singularly Swedish were seen as exclusive and discriminatory. For reasons they were shunned. When it came to religion, one had to tread carefully. Church had long since been separated from state, and now things had got to the stage where priests no longer mentioned God or Jesus or the Bible when addressing schoolchildren, since this could cause offense to the many who came from Muslim homes. It was the same ideology, hostile to all difference, that could not accept categories of male and female, he and she. Since han and hun are denotive of gender, it was suggested that a new pronoun, hen, be used to cover both. The idea that a human being was a gender-neutral hen, whose foremost task in life was to avoid oppressing any religion or culture by preferring his own. Such total self-obliteration, aggressive in its insistence on leveling out, though in its own view tolerant, was a phenomenon of the cultural middle class. That segment of the population which controlled the media, the schools, and the other major institutions of society, and it existed, as far as I could tell, only in Northern Europe. But what did this ideology of equality actually entail? A recent study said that the differences between pupils in Swedish schools had never been greater than they are now. The gap between the ablest children, for whom the future is bright, and the least able, whose futures lie outside the zone of influence and wealth, is widening year by year. The trend in the study is clear indeed. The strongest pupils are those from Swedish backgrounds. While we might be concerned not to offend people from other countries and nations, and go so far as to eliminate everything Swedish, this happens only in the symbolic world, the world of flags and anthem, whereas in the real world, everyone who does not belong to the Swedish middle class, which is hostile to all difference, is kept down and excluded. Most immigrants in Malmo, welcome as they are, live in ghetto-like public housing projects outside the center, in miserable apartments, in areas where unemployment is massive and the prospects dim. It is also the case that the middle class, hostile to all difference, prefers not to send its children to schools attended by children from immigrant communities, thereby further reinforcing the segregation with a knock-on effect on the next generation. Many immigrant children have parents with no education, and what the Swedish school system formerly considered to be a priority, lessening differences by providing equal opportunities to able and less able students alike, has now been completely invalidated as a guiding principle, the result being that the haves receive more, the haves not less. Equality in Sweden is confined to the middle class. They alone are becoming more equal. Elsewhere, the only equality is in the language, managed by the same middle class. In Sweden, something happening in language is much worse than happening in reality. An instance of one moral code applying in language and another in reality used to be called a double standard. This was what was going on at Vanya's last day of school event, the idea that everyone being equal, that fame and wealth being unimportant, applies in the language of the priest, whereas the reality surrounding that ideology said the opposite. The most important thing was to be rich and famous. And every child there harbored that dream. It was in the air. And the more I see of it, that self-blind and self-satisfied ideology of equality, believing as it does that the conclusion that it has reached is universal and true and must therefore govern us all, although in fact it is valid only to a small class of the privileged few, as if they comprise some little island of decency in an ocean of consumerism and social equality, the more the significance of my life struggle diminishes. For what differences does it make if I spend more or less time with my children, if I change their diapers or don't change their diapers, if I do the dishes or don't do the dishes, if I spend time on my work or don't spend time on my work? Oh, how then, for crying out loud, can we make the lives we live an expression of life rather than the expression of an ideology? And all the thou shalt nots by which our small middle class lives were constrained, all the things we weren't supposed to say or do, or else were obligated to say or do, how I longed not to give a damn and do as I pleased. Unquote. And here we see the twinkle in his eyes about being right-wing. Quote, the cafe I was in belonged to Lievich Art Gallery, whose rear was formed by the fourth and last wall of the garden area, and the cloistered passage at the top of the steps was part of it. The last exhibition I had seen there was Andy Warhol's work, which was I was out of my depth to judge as far as quality was concerned, whatever perspective I took. This made me feel ultra-conservative and reactionary, which I certainly did not want to be, but what could I do? Unquote. He also speaks of the loss of meaning under the conditions of modernity. Quote, there are many kinds of winds that blow through man, and there are other entities inside him apart from the depths of the soul, The authors of the books of the Old Testament knew that better than anyone. The richest conceivable portrayal of all the possible manifestations of humanness is to be found there, where all forms of life are represented, apart from one, for us the only relevant one, namely our inner life. The division of humanness into the subconscious and the conscious, the rational and the irrational, whereby one always explains or clarifies the other, and the perception of God as something you can sink your soul in, such that the struggle ends and peace prevails, are new concepts, inextricably linked to us and to our time, which not without cause has also let things slip out of our hands by allowing them to merge with our knowledge of them, or with our image of them, while at the same time turning the relationship between man and the world on its head. Whereas before man wandered through the world, now it is the world who wanders through man. And when meaning shifts, meaninglessness follows. It is no longer the abandonment of God that opens us to the night, as it did in the 19th century, when the humanness that was left took over everything, as we can see in Dostoevsky and Munch and Freud, when man, perhaps out of need, perhaps out of desire, became his own heaven. However, a single step backward from that heaven was all that was necessary for all meaning to be lost. Then it was evident that it was not only empty, black, and cold, but also endless. Dostoevsky has become a teenager's writer, the issue of nihilism a teenage issue. How this has come about is hard to say, but the result is that, at any rate, the whole of this vast question has been disregarded, while at the same time all critical energy is directed to the left, where it is swallowed up in ideas of justice and equality, which of course are the very ones that legitimate and steer the development of our society and the abyssless life we live within it. The difference between the 19th century nihilism as ours is the difference between emptiness and equality. In 1949, the German writer Ernst Jünger wrote that in the future we could have something approaching a world state. Now, when liberal democracy reigns supreme in modern societies, it looks as though he was right. We are all Democrats, we are all liberal, and the differences between states, cultures, and people are being broken down everywhere. And this movement, what else is it at heart, if not nihilistic? The nihilistic world is in essence a world that is being increasingly reduced, which naturally of necessity coincides with a movement towards a zero point, Jünger wrote. Unquote. Note here that he quotes Ernst Jünger, an explicitly right-wing German figure. My struggle also references right-wing figures or influences like Oswald Spengler, whose The Decline of the West Knausgård has read, and Japanese novelist Yukio Mishima. An interesting fact about Knausgård is that he was involved in creating an updated Norwegian translation of the Bible. Here's a bit of what he had to say about that. Quote, "It was at that time that I got a job working as a consultant on the Norwegian revision of the Old Testament, and since I had no grounding in the linguistic, cultural, or religious aspects that were involved, I had no option but to work hard and meticulously. Nothing was going to come to me on a plate. And what revealed itself then, when I went through the first sentence of creation word for word, for instance, was the way in which entire worldviews might be encapsulated in a comma, in an and, in a which. And with those insights, how different the world becomes if its description is coordinate with rather than subordinate to the metaphor. For example, or the way a word not only has lexical meaning, but is also colored by the context in which it appears, something the writers of the Bible exploited to the full, for instance, by allowing a word at the beginning to apply to the sun's relationship to the earth, and then to let that same word many pages on to apply to a man's relation to women. The word is merely there, in the two different places, and the connection is as good as invisible, yet decisive. People have been reading the Bible as Holy Scripture for a couple thousand years, and every word it contains has been considered meaningful. A dizzying tight mesh of different meanings and shades of meaning have thereby arisen, which no single human can ever possibly command. What happened when I started working on those texts was that I learned to read. I began to understand what it meant to read." Unquote. Michel Houellebecq. Michel Houellebecq, M-I-C-H-E-L, H-O-U-E-L-L-E-B-E-C-Q, is arguably France's most celebrated and infamous living novelist. His books have been eerily prescient, appearing shortly before events they seem to foreshadow, whether that be a terrorist attack or France's Yellow Vest protest movement. A deeply misanthropic writer, Houellebecq is one of the great diagnosticians of the diseases of our contemporary culture. A late boomer himself by birth, he ruthlessly critiques the legacy of the 68ers. His own unattractive physical appearance seems to be a mirror of his critiques. Unfortunately, Welbeck's novels are extremely sexually graphic, which makes them unsuitable for many people, but the sex is critically important in his work, which is harshly critical of the sexual revolution. In fact, he's one of the best, if not the best, at describing the consequences of our society's embrace of the ethic of sexual liberation. One book you could sample that is not in this mold is The Map and the Territory, which won the Prix Goncourt, France's top literary prize. His first novel, Whatever, published 30 years ago in 1994, correctly anticipated, among other things, the incel phenomenon and its link to violent crime and terrorism. Its central and most famous passage describes the neoliberalization of sex, with its resulting inequalities mirroring the economic world, something that I wrote about in newsletter number 21. Quote, "It is a fact," I mused to myself, "that in societies like ours, sex truly represents a second system of differentiation, completely independent of money. And as a system of differentiation, it functions just as mercilessly. The effects of these two systems are, furthermore, strictly equivalent. Just like unrestrained economic liberalism, and for similar reasons, sexual liberalism produces phenomenon of absolute pauperization. Some men make love every day, others 5 or 6 times in their life or never. Some make love with dozens of women, others with none. It's what's known as the law of the market. In an economic system where unfair dismissal is prohibited, every person more or less manages to find their place. In a sexual system where adultery is prohibited, every person more or less manages to find their bedmate. In a totally liberal economic system, certain people accumulate considerable fortunes, others stagnate in unemployment and misery. In a totally liberal asexual system, certain people have a varied and exciting erotic life, others are reduced to masturbation and solitude. Economic liberalism is an extension of the domain of the struggle. It's extension to all ages and classes of society. Sexual liberation is likewise an extension of the domain of the struggle. It's extension to all ages and classes of society." Unquote. Note that the extension of the domain of the struggle is the literal translation of the French title of the book. He also analyzes our society as suffering from a type of malaise or decadence in which human relationships above all suffer. Here are some quotes. Quote, "The world is becoming more uniform before our eyes. Telecommunications are improving. Apartment interiors are enriched with new gadgets. Human relationships become progressively impossible, which greatly reduces the quantity of anecdote that goes to make up a life, and little by little death's countenance appears in all its glory." He gets to his main thesis. Our civilization, he says, suffers from a vital exhaustion. In the century of Louis XIV, when the appetite for living was great, official culture placed the accent on the negation of pleasure and of the flesh. Repeated insistently that mundane life can offer only imperfect joys, and that the only true source of happiness was in God. Such a discourse, he asserts, would no longer be tolerated today. We need adventure and eroticism because we need to hear ourselves repeat that life is marvelous and exciting, and it's abundantly clear that we rather doubt this. Prolonged boredom is not tenable as a position. Sooner or later, it is transformed into feelings that are acutely more painful. Of true pain, this is precisely what is happening to me. I don't like this world. I definitely do not like it. The society in which I live disgusts me. Advertising sickens me. Computers make me puke. My entire work as a computer expert consists of adding to the data, the cross-referencing, the criteria of rational decision-making. It has no meaning. To tell the truth, it is even negative up to a point, a useless encumbering of the neurons. The world has need of many things, bar more information. Unquote. He also describes the destructive effect of free love. Quote, "She had certainly been capable of love. She would like to have still be capable of it. I'll say that for her, but it was no longer possible. A scarce, artificial, and belated phenomenon, love can only blossom under certain mental conditions, rarely conjoined, and totally opposed to the freedom of morals which characterize the modern era. Véronique had known too many discotheques, too many lovers. Such a way of life impoverishes a human being, inflicting sometimes serious and always irreversible damage. Love as a kind of innocence and as a capacity for illusion, as an aptitude for epitomizing the whole of the other sex in a single love being, rarely resist a year of sexual immorality, and never two. In reality, the successive sexual experiences accumulated during adolescence undermine and rapidly destroy all possibility of projection of an emotional and romantic sort. Unquote. Whatever was apparently a foundational text influencing the development of the so-called manosphere. His 1998 novel, The Elementary Particles, UK title Atomized, is widely considered Welbeck's masterpiece. It follows the life of two half-brothers, Bruno and Michel, damaged children of a 1968er-type hippie mother. Bruno is essentially a failure-in-life-turned-sex addict, while Michel comes a successful, if introverted, microbiologist who is working on what is in essence a transhumanism project. Once again, he traces the arc of the sexual liberation movement, noting its self-contradictory elements and how the people who promoted and embraced it ended up suffering downstream effects later in life. Having declared sex to be the supreme value, what does that do to the self-conception of those who have aged and are no longer sexually desirable? Quote, "Sexual desire is preoccupied with youth, and the progressive influx of ever younger girls into the field of seduction was simply a return to the norm, a restoration of the true nature of desire, comparable to the return of stock prices to their true value after a run on the exchange. Nonetheless, women who turned 20 in the late 60s found themselves in a difficult position when they hit 40. Most of them were divorced and could no longer count on the conjugal bond, whether warm or abject, whose decline they had served to hasten. As members of a generation who, more than any before, had proclaimed the superiority of youth over age, they could hardly claim to be surprised when they, in turn, were despised by succeeding generations. As their flesh began to age, the cult of the body, which they had done so much to promote, simply filled them with an intensifying disgust for their own bodies, a disgust they could see mirrored in the gaze of others. The men of their generation found themselves in much the same position, yet this common destiny fostered no solidarity. At 40, they continued to pursue young women, with a measure of success at least for those who, having skillfully slipped into the social game, had attained a certain position, whether intellectual, financial, or social. For women, their mature years brought only failure, masturbation, and shame." Unquote. Or as he puts it, "a world that respects only the young eventually devours everyone." Here again, multiple times, he draws an analogy between the sexual revolution and the raw forces of the neoliberal marketplace. Quote, "It is interesting to note that the sexual revolution was sometimes portrayed as a communal utopia, whereas in fact it was simply another stage in the historical rise of individualism. As the lovely word household suggests, the couple and the family would be the last bastion of primitive communism in liberal society. The sexual revolution was to destroy these intermediary institutions, the last to separate the individual from the market. The destruction continues to this day." Unquote. Perhaps Welbeck's most profound meditation on the malaise of the West is his novel Submission. Submission was controversial because it was nominally about a Muslim takeover of France, but that is not its true theme, which is that Christianity is dead in France, and because Christianity is dead, France is dead. The neo-reactionary blogger The Social Pathologist observed, quote, "For the literate moron, this book is about the Islamic takeover of France. For the Puritan, it is about the puerile expression of sex. For the feminist, it is about misogyny. But for the Christian reactionary, this book is deep, really deep." Unquote. The main character of this book, François, is a professor of literature who's a student of Joris Carl Wiesmann, a French writer of the decadent movement, who later in life turned to Catholicism. Trying to imitate his subject, François too goes in search of a spiritual awakening, but he doesn't find it. Quote, "I stayed until the reading ended, but once it was over, I realized, despite the great beauty of this text, I'd prefer to spend my last visit alone." What this severe statue expressed was not attachment to a homeland, to a country, not some celebration of the soldier's manly courage, not even a child's desire for its mother. It was something mysterious, priestly, and royal that surpassed Peggy's understanding, to say nothing of Wiesmann. The next morning, after I filled my car and paid at the hotel, I went back to the Chapel of Our Lady, which was now deserted. The Virgin waited in the shadows, calm and timeless. She had sovereignty, she had power, but little by little I felt myself losing touch. I felt her moving away from me in space and across the centuries, while I sat there in my pew, shriveled and puny. After an hour, I got up, fully deserted by the spirit, reduced to my damaged, perishable body, and I sadly descended the stairs that led back to the car park." Unquote. The Social Pathologist's excellent review observes, quote, "I think this is the pivotal point of the book. Here, where Swen Swa was actively reaching out for God, God failed him. Despite wanting to and seeing the need for it, Francois simply cannot invoke the religious impulse. Christianity is dead and, as the Christian God is, in Francois's eyes, intrinsically tied to the idea of European civilization, so is it. It is this central premise which provides the understanding as to why Islam achieves a victory in France and makes strides into Northern Europe as well. Welbeck realizes that Islam does not need to conquer by force. All it needs to do is fill the vacuum, as the ability to resist it is gone. Unquote. Again, I very much commend his review. I hope this sampling of three contemporary novelists helps illustrate how great art can speak profound truths about today's world in ways their creators may or may not have intended. Novelists very often explore the realities of the human condition and illuminate many of the dysfunctions of our modern world. Very often the people who do this are not Christian, and very frequently create scenes and use language many would find offensive. Bret Easton Ellis is a good American example here. But for those whose consciousnesses allow them to read these, many novels today identify and describe key truths our society would very much like to deny. Coda. Quote, "What I was trying to say in my usual incoherent fashion in The Prisoner of Sex is that biology, or physiology if you will, is not destiny, but it is half of it. And that if you try to ignore that fact, then you get, at least so far as I can see any perspective of the future, you then get into the most awful totalitarianism of all, because it's a left-wing totalitarianism. I think there's something in the human spirit that can somehow bear the notion of a fascist or right-wing totalitarianism, because it at least gives us the romantic dream that we can all form into underground cadres and have an adventurous life at the end, where all of us, women and men, are equal and comrades. But if we get a left-wing totalitarianism, that means the end of all of us, because we'll have nothing but scrambled minds trying to overcome the incredible shock that the destruction of human liberty came from the left, and not from the right. And there's an element in women's liberation that terrifies me. It terrifies me because it's humorless, because with the exception of, let's say, Germaine Greer's book on the female eunuch, there's been almost no recognition that the life of a man is also difficult, and that all the horror that men go through, some of them absolutely determined by men, even more, I suspect, than determined by themselves, because we must face the simple fact that it may be that there's a profound reservoir of cowardice in women, which had them welcome this miserable slavish life. But in any case, whether it's their fault or men's fault, what has to be recognized is that there's nothing automatic about female liberty. Every female liberty is going to be achieved the way that every liberty is achieved, which is going to be achieved against the grain, against the paradox of the fact that there's much in human life that forbids liberty. So I'm not here to say that every woman must have a child, or that every woman must have a vaginal orgasm, or that every woman must conceive in any way I lay down. Anyone who says that about me doesn't know how to read my sentences. What I'm trying to say is, let's get hip about this little matter, and recognize that the whole question of women's liberation is the deepest question that faces us. And we're going to go right into the very elements of existence in eternity before we're through with it, because the whole question of how much liberty women and men can find with each other, and how much sharing of these dishes they can do, goes into the center of everything." Unquote. Norman Mailer at a forum on women's liberation at Town Hall, April 30th, 1971.